7. We've got one work session and two public hearings, and we're going to proceed first with the work session in hopes that that will not take a long time, and then we can move on to the bills in the order in which they appear on the agenda, starting with House Bill 2905. So I will open a work session on House Bill 2923. Councilor Kelmanson, remind us what's going on with this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2423 was first heard on February 6th of this year, and it's a bill that reorganizes statutes relating to notices of agency actions in contested cases. There are a number of amendments, though I believe that's only the dash threes that are being put forth by the proponents right now, and I'll let them testify as to what they do, but just a quick summary. The dash threes corrects some unintended drafting errors in the original bill, and they also clarify some of the substantive requirements of agencies in providing notices, including that an agency must serve the notice on the parties either personally or by mail, identifying the notice in a general manner, the issues to be considered at the hearing. The agencies must explain that the parties may present evidence only if it is related to the issues that are subject of the hearing. It must state whether discovery is permitted and how it may be requested, and must inform the individual of all the circumstances under which a default order may be entered. The amendments also ensure that the officer presiding at the hearing will develop the record fully to include the facts and the law applicable to the facts and the issues before the tribunal.
And I think it would be helpful to us, committee, if we could have a presentation on the proposed amendments from the proponents of the bill from the Oregon Law Center. Ms. Berkowitz.
My name is Karen Berkowitz. I'm an attorney with the Oregon Law Center. And briefly, this bill was intended to kind of reorganize the notice and hearing provisions of the Administrative Procedures Act, because the act, as it's currently written, kind of mixes up the kind of notice you get before the hearing, when you're being notified of the agency's action, and the notice that you get that tells you the time and place of the hearing. The amendments to the bill basically restore some of the original language that was taken out in the drafting and was not intended to be taken out. It also clarifies that the notice needs to list the issues to be considered at the hearing in a general way, so that if, for example, an agency has pre-printed notices, because the issues are always the same, they can still use that without getting more specific. But on the other hand, for other agencies where the issues do differ, then they would still have to have a sufficient notice to let people know what the issue is going to be at the hearing. The notice will clarify that if you're not represented by an attorney, that you can ask for a recess at the hearing if you feel that you need representation. Of course, it's still up to the presiding officer to decide whether there will be a recess or not. It clarifies under what circumstances a default order can be entered, and also clarifies what the record will be if there's a default situation. It will include the agency's record plus information that the parties have submitted prior to the default. It also provides that the duty of the presiding officer is to make full and fair inquiry into the facts and do a correct application of the law to the facts. Again, this is what happens. This is the reality, so we don't see this as a change in practice at all. The record must also include ex-party communications that must be disclosed pursuant to other provisions of the APA. I'd be happy to answer any questions about what this bill does, but I just want to emphasize that it's really not affecting other provisions of the APA. It's not a substantive change. It's really just a change in what goes into notices and what must happen at the hearing.
Thank you, Ms. Berkowitz. Just to make sure I understand the paper that's in front of us, there's a dash 2 set of amendments from February 26 and then a dash 3, and I'm assuming the dash 3s supersede prior proposed amendments.
The dash 3 incorporates all the amendments.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Ms. Berkowitz, the purpose of the bill, including with the dash 3 amendments, is primarily to inform pro se parties, that is parties that are not represented by counsel, about what their rights are as they're going into a contested case hearing. Am I understanding that correctly?
Well, whether a person is represented or not, they should get the same information in the notice, but we are particularly concerned with pro se parties that they get sufficient information to know what's going to happen at the hearing and what they need to do to get a hearing.
Mm-hmm. Committee, are there any questions for Ms. Berkowitz? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we had testimony from the Department of Justice. Is somebody here from the Department of Justice, or do the dash 3 amendments incorporate the suggestions made by the Department of Justice?
Representative McPherson, Representative Bonamici. Christine Shute is here, but we have been working with them, and they agreed to the language. I don't know if you'd like to hear from her.
Any further questions? Then if none, no questions, then committee, we have amendments before us in the dash threes that appear to be a consensus product. At least I was seeing affirmative signals coming from Anel Schenkel from the Department of Justice from the back of the room. Do I hear a motion on the dash 3 amendments?
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 3 amendments into House Bill 2423.
Representative Barker moves the dash 3 amendments into House Bill 2423. Is there any discussion? Any objection? And the dash 3 amendments are in the bill. Is there a motion on the main bill?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2423 as amended to the floor with a new pass, and I believe this one would fit on the consent calendar.
I think that's appropriate. Representative Barker moves the House Bill 2423 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation for placement on the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
House Bill 2423, as amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation for placement on the consent calendar. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2423 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2905. Council Kalmanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2905 enacts the Revised Uniform Prudent Management of Institutional Funds Act, which provides statutory guidelines for the management, investment, and expenditure of endowment funds and the modification of restrictions on charitable funds. Among other things, the bill provides guidance on investment authority, permits delegation of authority to independent financial advisors, it authorizes the expenditure of the appreciation of investment funds, and provides rules for the release of restrictions on the use of investment of funds. The bill establishes that the appropriation of greater than 7% of the fair market value of an endowment fund creates a rebuttable presumption that the appropriation was imprudent. The bill requires persons responsible for managing and investing institutional funds to, quote, manage and invest the fund in good faith and with the care of an ordinarily prudent person in a like position would exercise under similar circumstances. The bill repeals provisions of Oregon's current Uniform Management of Institutional Funds Act.
Thank you, Council. We have Lane Shetterly signed up, who is with the Uniform State Laws effort. And, Mr. Shetterly, would it be appropriate for Susan Gary to join you?
It would, Mr. Chair.
Professor Gary.
I'll go ahead and get started and then turn the testimony over to Ms. Gary. For the record, Lane Shetterly, appearing you today and before you today in my capacity as a member from Oregon of the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws. Just by way of background on that, the National Conference has been it was organized 116 years ago. It is represented by members from all 50 states, as well as the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico. The commission meets on an ongoing basis and adopts uniform laws that then can be brought to the states for enactment, and thereby create a system of state laws that have uniformity in application to further commerce and the doing of business across state lines. Currently in Oregon, we have more than 50 uniform laws that are on the books, uniform commercial code being probably the most commonly recognized. But if you look in your ORS indexes, you'll see that we have adopted a good number of uniform laws. As counsel mentioned in the introduction, this bill before you today replaces what we have in the books today as the Uniform Management of Institutional Funds Act with an updated Uniform Prudent Management of Institutional Funds Act, also brought to you by the National Conference. Just one other bit of word on the National Conference. We have four members from Oregon that represent Oregon to the National Conference. They're appointed by the governor. I'm one. Joe Willis, a lawyer up at Schwabe Williamson in Portland, is another member. Carl Bier, a law professor at the University of Oregon, is also a member, as is Martha Walters, the new justice on the Supreme Court. And I'm pleased to say that Ms. Walters, Justice Walters, is poised to become Oregon's first president of the National Conference beginning in July of this year. So with that brief introduction of the commission itself, I'll turn the testimony over to Ms. Gary, who was a reporter for this act. That is, she carried most of the load in drafting and advising the committee of the conference that that drafted the Uniform Prudent Management of Institutional Funds Act, and is probably the leading national expert on the bill. So we're lucky to have her with us to give us the technical walkthrough of the bill this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Shetterly.
Good morning. Chair McPherson, members of the committee, my name is Susan Gary. I am on the faculty at the University of Oregon School of Law, where I teach trust and estates and nonprofit organizations, both subjects that relate to this bill. And as Mr. Shetterly said, I am the reporter, or was the reporter, for the uniform version of this bill, which became the foundation for the bill that's before you today, a product of a uniform drafting process. It took us 4 years to get it right. Let me just, you've heard a brief summary of the bill. Let me say a few more words about the bill. UPMIFA, and I'll refer to it by that acronym because it's easier than saying the Uniform Prudent Management of Institutional Funds Act each time. UPMIFA replaces the current law, which is UMIFA, a uniform act that Oregon adopted in 1975, and it's been the law here successfully since then. UPMIFA is, for the most part, an updating and modernization of UMIFA. I will identify a few places in which the law changes current, the bill changes current law, but for the most part, it was designed as an update of the existing law. The first thing that UPMIFA does is update the investment and management standards that apply to funds held by charities. This bill applies to, the term in the bill is institutions, but institution is defined as charities, and it applies to all funds held by charities, and applies a prudent standard with respect to the investment and management of those funds. The prudence standard comes from the Uniform Prudent Investor Act, which Oregon has adopted, and also uses language from the nonprofit code, which we have adopted as well, to emphasize that charitable funds should be invested based on prudence in a standard that applies to charities. It's really a melding of corporate and trust law standards. The Act provides a great deal of guidance with respect to prudence and the way that funds should be prudently managed more guidance than exists in current law. And so in that respect, it is, I think, helpful, but it doesn't change the standard. Prudence is a standard which evolves over time, and someone investing assets prudently under the current UMIFA would be investing under a standard based on this evolving concept of prudence that applies to these funds. The second thing UMIFA does is adopt a spending rule for endowment funds. Endowment funds are defined as funds that are funds not spent currently. Mostly we think of endowment funds as funds that are perpetual in nature, but this would also include funds that are not to be spent in the current year, but perhaps a fund to be spent over a 10-year period. The spending rule in UMIFA is a change from existing law. UMIFA was grappling with the problem that charitable funds were assumed to be covered by trust law, and the trust law spending rules in place back in the late 60s were limited spending from endowments to ordinary income, dividends and interest, and not appreciation of capital gains. And that made investing on a total return basis, which modern portfolio theory assumes is a more beneficial way to invest, made that difficult, if not impossible. Current UMIFA allows charities to spend appreciation above the amount of original dollars contributed to the fund, and those original dollars are termed historic dollar value in the existing law. Historic dollar value is an amount that reflects simply the original dollars contributed to the fund and not the current value of those dollars. So there's no increase for inflation or decrease for deflation. It's a rather arbitrary concept. UMIFA changes the approach, removes this concept of historic dollar value, replaces it instead with a much more detailed guidance, a much more detailed spending rule based on prudence, and tells the charity to spend in prudence based on a list of factors that prioritize the duration of the fund, the fact that for most of these funds the intent is that they last in perpetuity, and the intent of the donor in contributing money to the fund. The current bill, UMIFA, provides a lot more guidance in how that determination should be made than existing UMIFA, which simply uses the term prudence but doesn't spell it out very well. So there is a lot more guidance for the charities. In addition, with respect to the spending rule, this bill includes a presumption of imprudence. The concern was that perhaps charities would be tempted to spend more than they should, and a presumption of imprudence is a rebuttable presumption, but says that if a charity spends more than 7% of the total asset value of the fund in any 1 year, there will be a presumption of imprudence, which, again, the charity can rebut if there's an appropriate reason for spending in a particular year, 8, 9, or 10%. That can be established by the charity. And the presumption of imprudence does not mean that there is a presumption of prudence for spending below that amount. There is no presumption of prudence. The charities must exercise the fiduciary responsibility to make an appropriate spending decision, which indeed our charities do. The charities have developed spending rules, typically these days around 4%, and there is a lot of information available to charities about the way to manage endowment funds in a way that we on the drafting committee believe that carries out the donor's intent of a steady stream of spending over kind of indefinite number of years and the maintenance of the purchasing power of the underlying fund. That's the second piece. So we have the investment and management rules, the spending rule, and then finally some better guidance on modification of restrictions that were placed on funds held by charities. Restrictions can occur in two forms: restrictions on the administration of a fund or restrictions on purposes. Under trust law, we have information about how those restrictions can be modified over time. These often are funds that are intended to last in perpetuity, and after 50 years, things change, and a restriction that made sense 50 years ago may become impossible, impracticable, or wasteful over time. The trust code that was adopted in the last session contains those rules for trusts, and this bill incorporates the rules from the trust law and applies them to the charities covered by this bill, primarily charities organized as nonprofit corporations. It pulls in the doctrines from trust law, both deviation and CPRE, and allows modification after a court proceeding and after notification of the Attorney General. The one thing that is different from existing trust law is that this bill includes a provision that would allow a charity to make a modification of a restriction if a fund is old, defined as more than 20 years old, and small, defined as less than $25,000, would allow a charity to make a modification to that provision, again, as close as possible to the intent of the original donor, but without going to court. The charity would notify the Attorney General. The Attorney General would have 60 days to respond and block a modification that was proposed, but if the Attorney General did not move to block that modification, the charity could proceed. The reason for that is with some of these old funds, the amounts are very small, often much smaller than $25,000, and the cost of going to court exceeds the value of the fund. And so this is included in the bill to make the use of these funds more efficient for the charities. The overall reason for the bill and the hope with the bill is that with more efficient management of the funds, with better direction on spending rules, and with these modification provisions more clearly stated than they are under current law, the charities will be able to be more efficient with their money and have more of their funds and more of their assets left for their charitable activities, be able to carry out those activities in a better way. And in addition, we think that this bill protects the intent of the donors to all these funds. That's important too, and allows the charities to carry out the purposes for which the donors contributed these funds. I appreciate your time. I'm happy to answer questions. As Mr. Shetterly said, I was involved in drafting this bill, so I would hope to be able to answer anything that you can come up with.
Thank you, Professor Gary. Any questions for this panel? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Professor Gary, for being here from my alma mater. Have any other states adopted UPMIFA?
Yes, this was made, it was approved by the Uniform Conference in July, and so it is before the legislatures in 12 states currently. It's been adopted by South Dakota and Utah.
Thank you. Follow-up?
You may.
With your experience, do you anticipate that this will make it easier for nonprofit organizations to recruit board members, harder or have no difference?
Thank you, Representative Bonamici. That's a good question. I think it should make no difference. The guidance is, I believe, better, and that could make it easier. One of the things that struck me in working on this project was the limited understanding that many board members have of these rules. So one of the things I would like to be involved with is the education of board members so that they are aware that the rules exist. That's my hesitation. I'm not sure that board members would be thinking about this. I think because of the better guidance, it to the extent that board members are aware of this, it should help charities recruit board members. But I can't say that it would just because I'm not sure about how that would work out.
Thank you.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Gary, in your discussion on the modification of restrictions, you referenced some conditions that might not be applicable today that were applicable 50 years ago. Could you give us some couple of examples of what that might be, might be?
Thank you, Representative Flores and Chair McPherson. Yes, so for example, a university might have a nursing school, and someone might make a gift for scholarships for students to attend the nursing school. If the charity, if the university then closed the nursing school, there would be no way to make scholarships for those nurses. The modification would then be probably other scholarships, perhaps to students studying related fields, medical fields, something as close as possible to the original intent. One of the examples that's often used is the organizations that were created for the cure to try to do research on the cure for polio. Once that has been figured out and the disease, although I know it's not entirely cured, has a lot of progress has been made in that research, it makes sense to devote those funds to something else, perhaps some other childhood disease.
Thank you. An additional question?
Go ahead.
Thank you. And then in talking about grants that are or $25,000 or less, the small conditions. And are those oftentimes intended to be in perpetuity as well, and they're just kind of eased over a period of time, or
what? Yes, Representative Flores, that is the case. And I think one of the things we were thinking about are small scholarship funds, often created in honor of someone, a faculty member who died or an alumnus who died. And those scholarship funds are created with gifts that allow the scholarship to continue over time. But perhaps the purpose of the scholarship no longer makes sense, or it would be appropriate to combine that scholarship fund with another small scholarship fund to be able to be more effective in the scholarships, something like that.
Thank you.
Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. I have kind of a question in jest. If I understand this professor, do I get 3 credits?
Well, I don't know. If you get 3 credits, then I get to call on you.
and for somebody who has not been to law school, I would suggest Representative Kopp, that can be a brutal experience.
Well, I'm thinking
so. Or even for
so.
Those who have labored through that.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I wanted to say that I think this was the first time I've heard seat praise spoken since law school, as a matter of fact.
Likewise.
Yeah. she used it very well. I recognize the sound. If I may, just for the committee's information, with regard to the process of contacting the Attorney General's office, the committee may not be aware that the Attorney General's office maintains a charitable trust and activities section that oversees the administration of charitable activities and trusts in the state. And so that's the nexus for that contact here. And we have Susan Miller from the Attorney General's office here today to answer questions if you have any as far as the administration of this from the charitable trust and activities section is concerned. Mr. Chair, also, we've got an amendment that we're going to propose on this, and I think the Treasurer's Office is here with some amendment they want to discuss with you as well. It would be our intention today, I think, especially in light of the Treasurer's Office proposed amendment, to take some time to work with them on this and not ask you to move this bill today. We'll come back to you when you've heard from their amendments and we've had a chance to talk with them about it.
Very good. Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One sort of general question, a little bit more of an academic one, particularly in light of the amendment. With regard to the uniform nature of it, maybe you could say something about how that process works with the other states and whether, if in this sort of amendment, that would be consistent with other states. And would there be any situation where if one state didn't enact this concept and it would be inconsistent with another state, those sorts of things would be interesting. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Reed, Chair McPherson. The original act, UMFO, was enacted in 47 states. It was enacted very widely, and for a uniform act, that is extraordinary. Our expectation is that the same would be true of this act. It's already under consideration, as I mentioned, in 12 states, and it was only approved last summer. So we're guessing it will take 3 or 4 years for enactments to occur. The bills that I've seen so far from the other states are uniform in nature with one difference. The 7% presumption was in the original Uniform Act in brackets to indicate that that is an optional provision. The majority of the states, and I can't give you a precise number, but more states than not have not included that presumption, are relying on the underlying prudent standard. There are some states that are including the presumption, as Oregon is. But that's the primary difference. The amendment that Mr. Shetterly mentioned is a very minor one, that something that got dropped in the drafting process. That's part of the bill in the other states. The second amendment that you will hear about from Treasury has not been considered in other states.
Thanks.
Okay. There are no further questions, then I'll excuse this panel. Thank you very much, Mr. Shetterly and Professor Gary. I'd like to have a panel then of three people involved with this Treasurer's Office to come forward. Kate Richardson, Ron Schmitz, and Dee Carlson.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kate Cooper Richardson. I'm Chief of Staff to State Treasurer Randall Edwards, and I have here today Dee Carlson, who is with the Department of Justice and is one of the counsel to the Oregon Investment Council and the State Treasurer, and Ron Schmitz, who's the Chief Investment Officer Dakota State Treasurer and works with the Oregon Investment Council. We're here because we got a late look here at House Bill 2905 and initially did not think that it reached the funds that the State Treasurer and the Oregon Investment Council managed, but on closer examination, the question has arisen that it may reach some of the funds. One of, for example, perhaps the Common School Fund or some of the funds that might be interpreted under charitable purpose. Because of that, we are bringing forward a suggested amendment that would take those funds or make an affirmative statement that funds managed by the Investment Council and the State Treasurer would not fall under this, and that's because in Chapter 293 we already have a prudent investor standard that the Oregon Investment Council manages most of its funds under. And if you have specific questions about that, those should be for counsel and the investment professionals.
Do you have any other prepared remarks within your group? Okay. Appreciate that. And it's good to see my prior colleague, Mr. Carlson, who worked in our firm for many years and enjoyed working on a number of projects with him. So the question then is, how would the prudent standard that is in the law for, say, the Common School Fund or other funds that might be subject to this bill, how would it differ from this? I mean, what would be the problem if we had the same standard applying to those funds as were to apply to these totally non-public funds?
Chair McPherson, this is Dee Carlson with the Department of Justice. I would respond to your question this way. Our purpose is to make sure that we understand the responsibilities that we have investing for the state as the treasurer of the Oregon Investment Council and establishing policies for those investments. Presently, we have a set of standards defined in Chapter 293. If this bill were construed to apply to... First of all, we're not sure that it would apply to any of our funds. It would create some ambiguity as to whether some of our funds would be subject to two standards that already enunciated in 293 and what is now in this uniform bill. Most of the funds that the treasurer invests, that the OIC establishes policy for investment, are clearly outside of the parameters of this bill.
Okay.
I hope that's responsive to your question.
I think it is, although let me just pursue this a little further. The most significant impact of this bill, it appears to me, is the replacement of this old concept in UMIFA of historic dollar value with a 7% rebuttable presumption about, that is, that expending from the fund over 7% of average market value over a testing period for identifying that amount is rebuttably presumed to be imprudent. And is there any parallel concept, say, for if this Common School Fund were subject to this? And I realize you're not certain about whether it is or not the way the bill is drafted, but if it were subject to it, how would that differ from the way the Common School Fund is operated?
Well, Chair McPherson, you've asked a very good question. Most of what the treasurer does in terms of investment is related to investment, not expenditure. As an example, OPERF has a separate PERS board that develops spending guidelines. You have with the Common School Fund statutory standards as to what's appropriate for spending, what's not appropriate for spending. So we're not in the business of establishing spending requirements or spending standards or what is prudent for spending. We would like to keep that line as clear as possible. But separately, this would potentially conflict with other statutory standards that presently exist, for example, in the Common School Fund, about what is prudent for the state to spend for education, what's not prudent for the state to spend.
Okay. And is there any question under current law that we have an UMIFA uniform law, it's the prior uniform law, is it clear under that law that it doesn't apply to to the funds that are under the jurisdiction of the Treasurer's Office?
Well, Chair McPherson, I'm not an expert on UMIFA, but my understanding is it doesn't apply to government funds.
Okay. Any questions from the committee for this panel?
May I, Mr. Chair? It's our understanding, too, that the Oregon University System is interested. We manage some funds for them, and, of course, there's the endowment funds that are outside our jurisdiction. And there's some question with them about the application, especially with the spending policy. It's my understanding that they have a current spending policy right now that could be in place right now with the Oregon Investment Council. Am I right?
Yes, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. Basically, we assume, and the spending policy that we're given to work around basically comes from the higher ed board. It's not developed by the OIC. So we're working under, I believe the spending policy assumption is a 5% payout on a 3 to 5 year, based on a 3 to 5 year rolling rate of return. That can change at any time. Whatever statutory factors drive that spending policy, I don't really care about, with respect to this bill. I mean, that as long as it's legal, of course. But you are concerned from a pure investment perspective is that there are investment standards within this bill that may conflict with the existing set of investment standards that we operate under, and that's my area of concern, not the spending policy.
Mr. Chair, we're happy to work with the proponents to kind of address some of our concerns here.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So to be clear, and so that I'm understanding what you're saying, under the current law, UMIFA, you don't have conflicts or concerns about the structure and your current operation, but under the new provision of UPMIFA, you do?
That's my understanding, yes.
Thank you.
Okay, if there are no further questions, then we'll excuse you and we will ask you to come forward with what you think is the right fix to achieve clarity about whether this would impact the funds you're responsible for. We have one final witness signed up, Jay Kenton from the University System.
Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jay Kenton, and I'm the Vice Chancellor for Finance for the Oregon University System. I'm here today actually speaking on behalf of three parties, however. One would be the Oregon University System. The second would be I'm a board member for the National Association of College and University Business Officers. And thirdly, as you know, or as I believe you know, most of our universities have affiliated foundations. They're separate 501c3 corporations that manage endowments on behalf of their organizations, and I'm going to speak to you on their behalf as well. I'm here to speak in support of the proposed UPMIFA legislation. Last Saturday, the NACUBO Board, the National Association of College and University Business Officers, adopted a resolution to work with other organizations in the adoption of this legislation, to encourage our members to become advocates for this measure, and to support our members in all states to secure the introduction and approval of this Uniform Act in their legislatures. As you may know, the legislation has been introduced in 14 state legislatures this year and has already been signed into law in both South Dakota and Utah. In the West, I'm working with colleagues to secure this act's passage this year in Idaho, Montana, Nevada, Texas, and Utah. The Oregon University System and NACUBO believe that UPMIFA should be adopted for the following reasons. First, UMIFA, the existing law, needs to be updated. It is now 35 years old, and portions of this old act are now out of date. I will note that 35 years ago, when this body acted on UMIFA, they exempted the Oregon University System, and that may relate to some of the comments that you heard from the Treasurer's Office earlier. UPMIFA will also bring the law into alignment with modern investment practices. It provides for the implementation of whole portfolio management, specifically by diversification of assets, pooling of assets, total return investment, bringing the law governing charitable institutions into alignment with modern investment and expenditure practices. I would also note, though, that we are prepared to work with Treasury and will follow their advice in this regard for endowments that come directly to the state and are managed by the Board of Higher Education. They are subject to OIC, and we are prepared, as I said, to work with them on any amendment to this bill that they deem necessary. UPMIFA provides additional protections for charitable organizations and also protects the interests of donors who would like to see their contributions used wisely. The new act includes a better, modern rule for changing obsolete, inappropriate, or impractical restrictions, as you heard from Ms. Gary. UPMIFA refines investment obligations and clarifies the meaning of prudent expenditure of appreciation as well as income. The concept of historic dollar value as a floor beneath which an endowment cannot be spent is replaced with a new standard of prudence that applies to the decision-making process of governing boards. In general, UPMIFA will allow colleges and universities to be better stewards of these funds by better protection of trust corpus through diversification of assets, taking into account the changing character and kinds of assets available for investment, free of archaic restrictions, and being judged on overall performance of the endowment assets rather than on the performance of specific assets. I would encourage you to adopt this proposed legislation. I would note that I handed out a letter from the OSU Foundation in support of this legislation. I've also talked to the Portland State University Foundation and the Western Oregon University Foundation. They, too, support it. And I have not heard from any of our institutions or their foundations in terms of any opposition to this act. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Kenton. Mr. Chair. Representative Wisner.
Thank you. And I probably should have given this question to Professor Gary, but maybe you can help me, sir. Where's the teeth to the bill? If we look at page 2, where it says you may incur appropriate and reasonable, and you shall make a reasonable effort to verify facts. Who oversees or is the board the one that's going to have to look at this and put the bite into this bill, the teeth into the bill?
That's a good question, Mr. Chair. Representative Wisnett, I would say that, my office, the Office of Finance and Administration, we get trust documents, bequests, and others from donors. We maintain a file of those. We follow them to the letter, in terms of if we get an endowment as part of someone's will, it says, to hold in perpetuity for scholarships to be given to students majoring in certain categories of study or what have you. We ensure that institutions adhere to those restrictions. And our board is aware of this legislation. I haven't discussed it publicly with them, but privately the chair of the Finance Committee and the president and I have discussed it, and they agree that this act makes a lot of sense. I hope that addresses your question.
If you needed more detail, we might invite Professor Gary forward, too, since she is...
We can talk about it in the work session, but I just don't see a lot of enforcement. I don't see the enforcement aspect except to report back to the people who donated the money. Is that...
Let's have Professor Gary comment on this, if we could.
Thank you, Chair McPherson and Representative Wisnett. The enforcement comes in a number of ways. The first of all, and primarily, the Attorney General's office is the enforcement and the enforcer of all charitable funds. And we are fortunate in Oregon to have an active charity section. In some states, there is very little attention given to charities by the Attorney General's office due to lack of staffing. But that has been a priority in our Attorney General's office, and we are very lucky here. So that's, I think, important. The other pieces of this that provide the enforcement, the Act provides a lot of guidance to the charity in the kinds of things a charity should consider, particularly with respect to fees and the costs associated with managing funds. Those are part of a prudence calculation that the charity must make. It is up to the charity to do that, and you're right. It really is dependent on the board to make that decision appropriately. The reason that the drafting committee in putting this together thinks that it will work is that it has already. Existing UMIFA provides the same structure. The reliance really is on the charity to do that work, and the charities have stepped forward to do that. There is a lot of material out there in terms of best practices and spending rates that are appropriate, guidance on investment decision making that the charities use, organizations like Nakubo that exist to help various institutions make those decisions. So there's a lot of history of charities doing the right thing. In addition, it's in the charity's best interest. And I say that because the charities depend, most charities depend on receiving more money from donors. If the charity is mismanaging the money, donors tend to find out about it. And that often is a better enforcement mechanism than even the Attorney General's office, because the donors will step forward and either stop giving more money or more likely make a fuss and let other potential donors know that they should not contribute to a particular charity. So for those reasons, we think that the teeth are there. They do rely on things outside the bill itself.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Any further questions? Then I'll excuse both these witnesses, and since we are expecting amendments, then we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2905 and hold a work session off until another time. And I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2906. Councilor Cummins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2906 establishes that a person claiming to be aggrieved by unlawful discrimination in public education and not simply higher education, which is in the current statute, may bring a discrimination action in circuit court if they comply with a grievance procedure.
And we have a single witness, Andrea Meyer.
Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. Despite this being an ACLU bill, it is my hope and expectation that this will almost be the least controversial matter that I will testify before this or any other committee this session. House Bill 2906 fixes a procedural problem in appeals to school discrimination claims. It does not make any other change to the law. It does not give any new rights, but it streamlines the process and aligns it with higher education. Let me give you some background. 659.850 prohibits discrimination under race, religion, sex, so on. In 1987, and my testimony said 1985, I misspoke or miswrote, the law was amended to permit higher education claims to go to circuit court after the parties attempted to resolve it before the school. However, the same opportunity was not made for K through 12, and the result has been to generally increase the cost to all parties involved and force years of resolution to claims like this. So currently, let me talk briefly about the procedural requirements. The internal process for K through 12 in higher education is the same. You must give a school a chance to resolve the matter. And we think that's a good idea, and that's not changed. However, under ORS 659-860, the law in front of you, claims there can then go on to circuit court for higher education. What happens to claims not resolved for K through 12? They must go to the superintendent of public instruction. And when you go before the superintendent of public instruction, your case now becomes an Administrative Procedures Act case. No other discrimination law in the state of Oregon goes under the APA. And past experience and consultation with experts who deal with administrative agency law, the conclusion is really this makes no sense. The agency's not the right place. They don't necessarily have the right expertise. It tends to make it complicated and lengthy. Now, under the Superintendent of Public Instruction, there either is a hearing or there's no hearing. If there's a hearing, the administrative agency hearing officer, who again may have no training or expertise, hears the case. If there's no hearing, the party appeals to, the, or party can appeal to the circuit court. but it's not like your normal case that you know of in circuit court. It's a review of other than contested case under ORS 183.484, and that is the Administrative Procedures Act law. The court then is restricted in the type of review it can give, and the superintendent of public instruction becomes a defendant in the case. Now, one of the limited options the circuit court has is to remand the case back for a hearing. But now you would have the superintendent, who's been a defendant, step back into the shoes of being a neutral adjudicator. And that makes, to us, little or no sense. The end result has been and can be years of litigation, which is costly, particularly to the school. So we believe no one benefits. It removes an inappropriate administrative appeal process and resolves what are truly few and far between cases more quickly. So what House Bill 2906 does is it simply removes the superintendent of public instruction as both an adjudicator and a party. It removes the hurdles established under the Administrative Procedures Act. It allows students and families to put facts before a neutral judge to determine the law in a timely manner that helps either the family be vindicated or move on in a timely manner. We very much appreciate your consideration today. I'm happy to ask any questions, and we hope you pass out House Bill 2906 with a due pass recommendation to the floor. Thank you.
Any questions for Ms. Meyer? Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Meyer, do you have examples of some situations where this has been a problem and there have been cases that have been under the Administrative Procedures Act in K-12 situations?
Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, we do. And as I said, and you can see that there's no one here in opposition to this, and I have talked to all the stakeholders, and so I think their lack of presence is an indication of this committee that there's no objection. But yes, and the result has been just as I've described. We had a case, and when the ACLU brings cases, we're not looking for a monetary award. We're looking to have the issue resolved by law. And we did have two cases, and it ended up taking over a decade. At the trial, when we got to the trial court level, having not received a hearing at the superintendent level, because there was so much procedural litigation involved, and we prevailed at the trial court, and it was simply we were remanded back to a hearing. In addition, we received our attorney's fees. That was $100,000 against the school district and the state. Now, for non-lawyers, that sounds like a large amount, and actually for practitioners, that's an extremely high amount. The case eventually resolved, and we didn't win attorney fees awards, but under the current process, we were eligible, and it doesn't change this. But our frustration was years and years and years of litigation unnecessarily because of the APA process. And as I said, the school paid the higher price. Our attorneys don't charge us, and we're not looking to make money off of these claims. We're looking to resolve the issue. But the school needs to defend, and when it takes that long, it can be extremely expensive to them. And that's actually part of the reason we're here, is let's get rid of that delay and get the claims vindicated quickly and move on.
Follow up.
You may.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So a couple of cases in the past number of years, that is kind of what has brought this to focus for you. And then once again, I do question that we have an emergency clause on this bill that indicates that to protect the public peace, health, and safety. So I'm curious about why we feel that this is an emergency.
Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, to be honest, I hadn't noticed that, although I don't think that would create any problem in doing that. I think it's an appropriate remedy to have in place. It doesn't create any real difficulties for anyone to comply with that, as opposed to needing to put together rules and regulations and a process. So I would think that would be an appropriate thing to do. Again, no one is here in opposition. I think it needs to happen, and it probably should therefore then happen quickly.
Thank you.
Representative Kump.
Just a couple of comments to you, Chair McPherson, and the committee of school in support of this bill. Schools are not set up to do litigation whatsoever. I have my superintendent's license and all my coursework, believe it or not, I've had one law class. That tells you how minimal our background is in litigation. I know that in the school district in which I have been employed, if a family or a student sees any sort of discrimination, their first call is to the Office of Civil Rights. And that means a minimum of a 5-year process, an incredible amount of money, and usually hardly any resolution of the actual problem. And then also, in support of what Ms. Meyer said, we had another situation full 10 years ago, and I don't think it's been resolved yet. This is not a school administrator's expertise, and anything to help us out would be, I think most administrators would say, be appreciated.
Cameron.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Myers, I'm just reading section 1, paragraph 3, and I thank you for coming in advance to share this bill with me as well. But I'm trying to understand line 13 through 16, where we reference that no action shall be filed, and we talk about going to the school district board, a public charter school governing board, which are small entities. But then we include the Community College Board of Education and the State Board of Education, which are larger entities. So, and I'm just trying to get my hands around this, that if there's a problem with, for example, at Western Oregon State University, it has to be appealed through the Board of Higher Education. But if there's a problem with Salem-Keizer School District, we're eliminating that appeal process to the State Board. Why are we keeping the higher boards of higher education and community colleges, but restricting it to small school districts? Can you explain that?
Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, my answer would be that I don't believe in reading this. It requires that you also go to the State Board of Higher Education. It says Community College Board of Education, or the State Higher Board. You're right. This is intended to streamline it. So it's a school district board. Actually, what happens first under most situations in K through 12 is first you go to the principal. In other words, there's a layer of process. And first you go to the principal, and if there's no resolution, maybe a higher up, and then the school board, which has the assistance of legal counsel. If you get the superintendent of public instructions involved, you get sent through the APA process. But that does not happen under this with the higher education board. So it's the intention of this to give us to give, and the request was to give the similar process and procedures available. Schools already handle these and would continue to at the lower level. But after the administrative process within the school system and the school board, it would then allow you to go on.
Follow up if I may. What about a small school district? I don't know what the smallest school district is in the state of Oregon, but do they?
Three students. I had one.
So, and to follow along with Representative Comp's honesty and transparency about not being an attorney, isn't that one of the reasons why we have maybe this larger body that could be appealed to, so we don't end up in court? We have a chance to reconcile some of the differences and correct those things versus a very small school district that doesn't have the ability to handle that on their own. This thing could go to a different level before it ends up in court. Wouldn't that be an advantage to those smaller school districts?
Chairman McPherson, Representative Cameron, I want to answer you, but I also saw Representative Bonamici. I didn't know if you wanted to.
I'll let you answer.
The response, Representative Cameron, is that's the highest level of the elected body for that organization. And whether you have a school district of one or, 10,000, you still have an elected school board. It's part of this, the governance for public education. So Yeah, that's the highest elected body you can go to.
Mr. Chair, I think the superintendent of public schools is an elected official in the state of Oregon.
Yes, she is, but I don't know the statute under that, but in a school district, that's your highest elected entity, because the state superintendent is a different anyway. But you're right, but I don't know the statute around that.
Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, recommendation, I mean, certainly a school district can seek the advice of the superintendent of public instruction, particularly smaller ones that might, and again, I really want to reiterate, these claims are few and far between, and I only know this because I dealt with it personally for over a decade and saw this as a need to be fixed, but I don't know how many claims are ever even brought to a school to say we've got a concern, but clearly if there are, they're generally resolved internally. But to the degree that a school district has concerns for, and they've got the school board, they've got the ability to access counsel, they've got the ability to access the superintendent of public instructions to seek guidance and assistance in resolving it. And then if that doesn't happen, and you've gone through the process, we're moving this to a circuit court consistent with all other discrimination cases makes sense to us because putting another administrative hurdle in front of it just costs everyone more time and potentially gets you into an Administrative Procedures Act, which, as I've explained, greatly lengthens the cost. And again, unfortunately, and it's not our desire, the cost tends to be to the school district when you have layers and layers of administrative process. So we think by having it where you must complain, and school districts can set up their own procedures, and they do. I can speak to one. You must complain first to the principal. Then you complain to the higher up, and that sometimes may be another entity before you actually go then to the school district superintendent, who then would make a recommendation to the school board for consideration. So there's been a lot of opportunity to see if this can be worked out, and if it can't, we think the expertise of a judge, assuming it even gets there. And again, you have, I want to reiterate, this isn't creating a new right to get to court or a new right to sue or new exposure to the litigation issues for a school district. It just intends to actually streamline it after opportunities to engage internally and somewhat informally don't resolve.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Meyer, thank you for bringing this to us, and I hope I can help clarify things, because I think when the case goes under existing law to the superintendent, it still ends up in the court system. Because the APA hearing is held, and then if it's not held, they can appeal, and if it's held and they don't like it, they can appeal. So it still goes to the court system. It doesn't eliminate that step. And in your two cases that you talked about, were either of the cases resolved at the superintendent's?
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, no, they were not resolved at the superintendent level. And by bringing them into the superintendent level and getting placed into the APA, as I said before, it ended up costing the school district. And the school district not only got an award of attorney's fees, but I'm aware of the school district's attorney's fees, their own attorneys, over $200,000, and I'm not sure that's the complete price. And again, that's not what we're seeking to have, either an award of attorney's fees that's huge or that the school incur hundreds of thousands of dollars. And the only reason that happened, let me assure you, the only reason was because we were in the APA process and we were doing motion after motion and argument with the superintendent, now a defendant in the case, and two defendants. And I won't get into the APA problems in case law. It just goes to prove that agencies are good at many things, but no other discrimination claim by any entity, anyone in the state of Oregon, puts it through the APA process. And there's probably good reason.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
Thank you. And with regard to the paragraph 3 on page 1 that Representative Cameron was talking about, it's my understanding, and I hope you can correct me if I'm not understanding this correctly, that what this is intended to do is just set forth that first it should be
the issue should be taken to the local mm-hmm. level, and their grievance is filed with the school board, and it's tried to resolve it there. And then if it doesn't get resolved there, then consistent with higher education, which is the way it's working, first you try to resolve it on the local level, then you go to the courts.
Chair McPherson,
just making it consistent with higher education.
Representative Bonamici, indeed, and that was our request.
And one follow-up comment. I think in K to 12, there's even more of a need to resolve things quickly because children are in the system, and by the time these cases are getting resolved, they're out of the system, and it just doesn't make sense for those cases to take so long.
Right. Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, the other risk is if cases take an extremely long time, because of Oregon's unique standing in the country about not allowing capable of repetition but evading review, it means that if the kid were to, we started litigation when he was in first grade, but if he graduates, potentially the case can get moot. That doesn't mean the issue goes away, and another family may step in. And so, but the first case will go away, and then another family has to renew the litigation, and that just ends up costing everyone a lot more money. So there's really good motivation on all sides to get what is justice here? What's the right way? Is there a meritorious claim? If there is, fix it. If there isn't, move on. And that's really what serves everyone more in lots of different ways, both from the justice aspect, if something is happening that shouldn't be, or from the administrative and cost and student aspect, move on if there isn't. And so we think for all the reasons, including Oregon's bizarre being the only state that has that, this will help resolve these things in a timely manner that reduce costs. And again, I do just want to reiterate that no one behind me is here to testify in opposition, and that's because I did talk to all the stakeholders. And even those that might be our adversary in litigation are not here expressing objection to this. It works in higher education. These cases are few and far between. It's worked in higher education, and there's no reason to assume that this doesn't just assist the K through 12 process a little bit better as well.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Meyer, I agree with you that probably the most expedient way to handle these things is rather than go through the cumbersome process of the administrative law process, and we could probably have some interesting discussion about that, to put them directly into the circuit court proceeding. However, I'm looking at Section 3, which talks about rolling in public charter schools, and Section 4, which talks about private alternative education programs. So you are talking about K-12 system, and so how are we focusing on, I understand we're talking about K-12 system where public monies are expended in public charters and public and private alternatives are receiving public benefits. But are we focusing on issues that might be coming to your attention from public charters and public alternative education systems?
Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, the quick answer is no, but let me explain why that's in there. Look, if you would be so kind, on page 2, line 16, and it's the same for both charter and the alternative programs. Line 16 already prohibits discrimination. So there's a choice that these entities already are prohibited from discriminating based on race and religion in their own practices. And that's what 659.850 is and 659.855. So what 659.860 says is consistent with the process we're setting up to streamline all high education. We should do the same here. If they're going to be subject to it, they should go through the same procedures, the internal process and grievance, and then if no resolution, circuit court. Otherwise, if you didn't change this law to be identical with what we are doing with all the other law, it would get stuck into the Superintendent of Public Instruction and the APA and the whole problem. So the degree that the policy was already made, that there's a whole bunch of laws that they must comply with, this is just making it consistent and not leaving it out, and I'm appreciative that LC caught the consistency to make sure we'd have no weird gaps in the law and a different process for them. Everyone should be trained the same way and provided the same resources, and so I would think it would be really problematic to exclude them out and have them go through the agency process and the superintendent as the adjudicator. They might not be real thrilled by that.
Follow up.
You may.
Thank you. And Then in regard to your comment that you've talked to all stakeholders, so you've talked to people from public charter schools and alternative education providers as well?
Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, no, indeed. Sorry, I hadn't really perceived them as a particular stakeholder who's been involved in this kind of matter. I've talked to those particularly related to the defendants who often and the entities that represent the defendants, but no, to be honest, I haven't, although this has been out here, and I've tried to let folks know that it's going on, and no one has come to me. And the good thing about this bill, by the way, is because it has our name on it, it's not a hidden secret who's doing this, and I would have hoped that if anyone had some concerns or questions about what it was all about, they would have been free to contact me and talk about what our goals are and what we're trying to do, and that didn't happen.
Mr. Chair, additional follow-up?
Go ahead.
Thank you. And Ms. Meyer, so then where is the assurance for us that this applies to not only public charters and public alternative education providers, but public K-12 system overall?
Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, the discrimination law 659-850 is no person in Oregon shall be subjected to discrimination in any public, elementary, secondary, or community college education program or service school, interschool activity, or higher education in whole or part with monies appropriated to the Legislative Assembly. Then 659-860, the first line says any person claiming to be aggrieved by unlawful discrimination as amended as prohibited by 659-850. So you didn't have the statute before it, but this is part of a number of statutes, and I've just kind of read to you actually the guts of the underlying statute, 659-850. So that qualifies what the entities are, and it's very clear, and there's no dispute that that is public elementary, secondary, community colleges, and higher education in the state of Oregon that receive funding in any part from the Legislative Assembly.
Thank you.
So Wisnett had a question to help that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So follow up of Representative Flores, because I've had constituents, so that we're sure that homeschoolers or private charter schools, they were required to go through the superintendent. With this bill, they don't have to go through the superintendent. They'll go directly to the courts. Do they have any person between?
Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnett, no action can be filed unless one proceeds with the school district board. It would be whatever structure, and I'm not particularly familiar with those entities, but it would be, and if someone else is, feel free to speak up, but it would be with ever. All schools are required under the law to set up a procedure to which someone can claim and grieve in front of them, and this law does require that you grieve internally first. But you might be getting better information from your counterpart right next to you. So.
Thank you. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to follow up on one of your answers to Representative Flores' question about, you said you talked to the stakeholders. Did you talk to the Oregon School Boards Association about this bill?
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, I certainly did.
And follow up?
Right.
Sorry, it was a really poorly phrased question on my part. What did they say?
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, they said they wouldn't be here today. I guess they did not have sufficient concerns or about this to come in and raise objections with you. I think it's probably fair to say they're somewhere along the lines of neutral, but we had many discussions, and they communicated to me last week that they would not be here to express opposition to this proposal. And I suspect it's because higher education processes worked with little problems, and all the reasons I've already articulated, hopefully were persuasive to them. But yes, extensive conversations, because I wanted to make sure that would be the folks who would have most concerns.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Meyer, for bringing this bill. And just in a way of comment, it seems to me that if it takes years to resolve something, we need to change it. So.
Okay.
Years to do the bill.
Yeah. If there are no further questions, then I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2906 and open a work session on House Bill 2906. We've had a lot of discussion here with a single witness on this bill, colleagues. It looks like it's at least being acquiesced to by the other stakeholders, and it would move things more quickly to the decision maker, where generally these kinds of issues are going to be resolved anyway, which is in circuit court. Do I hear a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2906 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2906 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cameron.
Yeah, I will be a no vote today with the opportunity to talk to my local school district superintendents, and once I confirm from them they don't have any problems, I would probably change my vote on the House floor.
Understand.
Thank you.
Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to be a no vote today, not because I don't agree in concept, but I would like to talk to the stakeholders from public charter schools and private alternative schools, which Ms. Meyer did indicate that she did not have the opportunity to talk with, to get their input on this bill. And that does not mean I will vote no on the floor, but I will would like to have the opportunity to have that those discussions.
Very good.
Chair.
Representative Krieger.
I'll vote yes for the bill today and get it to the floor. If something does come up that was unforeseen, then I reserve the right to reconsider on the floor.
Sure.
Mr. Chair.
Representative
Bonamici. I just wanted to comment, and I guess we could have asked Ms. Meyer this question, but when you're talking about homeschoolers or private schools, you're talking about a totally different allegations of discrimination, and you're under different laws. So it's my understanding that this bill applies to discrimination claims with regard to public entities. Is that your understanding, too,
Council? Yes, it is.
Representative Flores.
And thank you. Just with the extension, Representative Bonamici, that those public funds do extend to charter schools and private alternative schools, and those are the interest holders that haven't been communicated with in regard to this, and those are the bases I would like to touch.
Can I ask a question? Maybe you know the answer to this, Council. Then it's my understanding that those claims would go to the board of the jurisdiction that is with that authorized that charter. For example, if it's a charter school in the Portland School District, then they
school
go to
board.
The Portland board.
Yes.
Is that your understanding, too?
That is my understanding also. I don't know if Ms. Meyer has a different understanding, but that's...
Page one.
That's
you say no or you don't?
No, I don't have a different understanding.
Okay.
Right, so I think you're correct in that.
Well, the only follow-up would be for, like, homeschoolers, their governing body is the Education Service District Board, which is...
What are you going to discriminate against?
Well,
I'm
not
claiming discrimination against...
Well, what...
Unbelievably,
school districts can deny requests for materials and such to homeschoolers, and they legitimately could... say that their child's being discriminated against. And so there are, it's like any other rule in law, there's always an exception. Yeah.
And colleagues, I appreciate the position taken by some committee members that they would be a no vote for now, subject to checking things out. And, well, earlier in the session, we might have held a bill over so that could happen. I think we're getting deep enough into the session now where we need to be moving things along. But I do urge you to explore those things and explain if you encounter concerns from those quarters. By all means, bring them to our colleagues on the floor. Is there any further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll on the motion by Representative Barker to move House Bill 2906 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bonamici. Aye. Representative Cameron. No. Representative Flores. No. Representative Flores. Aye. Representative Cox. Aye. Representative Krieger. Aye. Representative Reed. Aye. Vice Chair Barker. Aye. Vice Chair Wizard. Aye. Chairman Person. Aye.
House Bill 2906 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Bonamici, would you carry the bill on the floor?
I'd be proud to. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you very much. I'll now close the work session on House Bill 2906. Colleagues, that concludes our work today. Thank you for your attendance. We're adjourned.